From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we'll listen to our Across the Red and Blue Divide panel discussion about criminal justice reform in Wisconsin. What can we all agree on when it comes to change?
We'll hear from a Milwaukee judge, plus lawmakers on the left and on the right, and a formerly incarcerated man now working to improve the lives of people coming out of prison.
What I've seen over the years is that we seem to be immune to any type of reform in our state.
And political satirist Will Durst weighs the differences between performing in his childhood home of Milwaukee this week with what he'll see on his upcoming European tour.
I don't know.
I don't know. I'm just wondering.
I know what you're going to ask, and I don't know. I've heard that people are so tired of hearing about Trump. I've heard that people can't get enough of Trump.
Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. In a state with a growing prison population and a growing awareness of mass incarceration as a social issue, the idea of criminal justice reform has many entry points. Some see it as a civil rights issue, others as a budgetary necessity, and still others approach it as an issue that touches nearly every aspect of community life.
And while the remedies may differ, people of many political philosophies agree that criminal justice reform ought to be part of the public policy agenda. But where should reform begin? That question guided our latest Across the Divide event presented in conjunction with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
For the event called Across the Red and Blue Divide, Reforming Criminal Justice, we also partnered with the Zeidler Center for Public Discussion and the Millennial Action Project. Our audience at the Bavarian Beer House talked about the issue in discussion circles after they listened to a panel conversation. That conversation was moderated by me, along with the Journal Sentinel's Aaron Richards.
It featured Jerome Dillard, State Director for EXPO, or Ex-Incarcerated People Organizing, plus Republican State Representative Rob Hutton of Brookfield, Democratic State Representative David Bowen of Milwaukee, and Milwaukee County Circuit Court Judge Jane Carroll. She started the conversation by explaining how her experiences inform her approach to criminal justice reform.
Well, I think we can't have this discussion without talking about trauma. And when you look at this problem through the trauma lens, everything shifts. We're learning more and more about trauma, how it affects individuals and their ability, their actual neurological ability to make decisions, and how it affects communities. And when you frame criminal justice reform in terms of the trauma that the community has felt, that the individuals have felt, and look at ways of healing that trauma, that I think is a starting place to guide our direction from there.
Thanks a lot, Judge Carroll. Next, we'd like to go to Representative Rob Hutton, who represents Brookfield in the State Assembly. How have your experiences shaped your approach or your thinking on criminal justice reform?
Yeah, well, thank you for letting me be a part of the panel this evening, and I applaud this group. It's not always easy to get two organizations to work together more than four or five that are represented here this evening, so I applaud that. And I applaud this discussion regarding criminal justice. My focus has really been high level to some degree as to where we are today relative to our criminal justice system. And I think when we talk about criminal justice reforms, I've kind of been mentored by a few that there are kind of buckets that you look at. There's that pre-incarceration dynamic in our society that we need to be looking at and dealing with. There's the incarceration phase of folks that are in our prison system. Was mentioned 23,000 individuals that are currently in our state prisons. And there's the post-incarceration phase of 99% of the inmates that we have in our state prisons will be coming out at some point in time, whether that's within 6 months or 6 years, we will be seeing those folks back in our community. And so a lot of my work almost by default has been looking at the last phase of, as I've talked to inmates and have had interaction with them, there's been a tremendous amount of, I think, frustration with inmates that are truly seeking a second chance and a new opportunity post-incarceration, that our current system is not aligned very well to help those folks succeed. I hear stories and stories of folks that have gone from agency to agency looking for help, looking for services that ultimately wind up back where they started and are ultimately either defeated or they choose to give up because the process is so difficult. So I've really tried to work on opportunities to engage the community, both government-wise and nonprofit-wise, to say, where are your strengths and how do we help you align, not once folks are out, but even while they're still in, to deal with issues that are going to be fundamental to them when they do come out. Trauma was discussed. We talk a lot about skilled trades, being able to prepare folks to actually have a job when they come out. But there are a lot of fundamentals that need to be worked on and looked at and dealt with individuals, because I certainly don't appreciate it, but the longer you've been in, the more the world has kind of passed you by, and you have a lot of catching up to do. And we need to make sure we have the safety net for those folks coming out, the peer-to-peer support, the mentoring support to bridge that gap so folks have the ability to get back on their feet and actually be contributing members to society, which there are a tremendous amount of inmates in our current prison population that are looking to do so.
Thank you so much, Representative Hutton. We're also pleased to welcome David Bowen, a Milwaukee Democrat who represents District 10 in the State Assembly. Representative Bowen, we just heard from your colleague from across the aisle. How do your experiences form your approach to criminal justice reform?
Thank you, Mitch, and thank you, Aaron, for the invitation to be here. Excited to have this conversation, period. As I think about my experience in the legislature, I can actually start there. And one of the important folks I had a chance to meet was Grover Norquist. Anybody recognize that name? Okay. So Grover Norquist, very famous for no tax hike pledges. And he came to the Capitol to talk about criminal justice reform, ironically. And in his perspective, there were a number of things and best practices that legislatures and folks in government should do to stop growing the amount of people that are in our criminal justice system, that are being incarcerated. And a number of the things that he highlighted the state of Wisconsin has traditionally done to explode our incarceration number. Now, that was in the beginning of the session, and one of the things he highlights are mandatory minimums, for instance, where a judge doesn't have the discretion to assign the time incarcerated for an individual that has committed a crime that by policy says that you cannot have discretion, you must give this certain amount of time. And even though he came to the legislature to plead with us not to do mandatory minimums, we still, as a state, passed mandatory minimums. Now, what's interesting is my experience comes from working with high school students and young people and getting them to see the potential that they have to really shape and transform the world around them. But it does get difficult when we do have a political environment that in a sense can't be accountable to even best practices or can't be accountable to what makes sense or actually will move us in the right direction. So it becomes really frustrating for me to then go back even further and to even question, well, do we really believe that criminals deserve to be treated justly, right? Have we been over dependent on putting people in situations where we know that it won't make them better, but it's because we've always done it. We believe in having folks incarcerated in cells, in facilities, and we have been so used to it, and it's kind of like we've been addicted to it, right? So I think, where does it start? It starts actually even before it gets to the legislature. Do we as a community, as a city, as a suburb, as a state, do we believe that we should have a system that actually makes people better or makes them worse? I think it starts there.
Thank you, Representative Bowen. And now we have Jerome Dillard, who is the director of Ex-Incarcerated People Organizing, and I'd like you to talk about how your experiences influence your approach to criminal justice reform.
Well, first of all, I want to say thank you for having me. I want to thank the sponsors of this organization, of this event, for having me here. As she said, I'm the director of ex-incarcerated people organizing. I, too, am a formerly incarcerated person who has spent roughly 12 years inside two different prison systems. I've been doing this work in this state for the last 15 years as an employee of one of our correctional facilities, the Wisconsin Resource Center, and also as the director of Dane County's reentry programs. What I've seen over the years is that we seem to be immune to any type of reform in our state. We can be smarter and wiser in how we spend our dollars. And I want to put up something that Representative Hutton and I had an opportunity of visiting two prisons in Texas. And we were looking at a model there. And in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, there's some other things that we can look at that Texas is doing. Not to say that it is the grandiose model, but Texas is closing prisons and their population is going down along with crime. The way we're doing corrections here in Wisconsin has been a little frustrating for me, for the simple fact that individuals are cycling in and out, in and out. You can go on probation, eventually wind up inside the institutions, and individuals' lives are being derailed. Representative Hutton mentioned something about peer support. I am a key supporter of peer support. I believe that those who are closest to the problems are closest to the solutions. In the work that I've been doing over the past 15 years, it is often inside the institutions, I could say something and all the social workers will say, I said the same thing, I said the same thing. But I think it's where it's coming from, and having that lived experience, I believe, can play a role. We have overlooked those individuals who have the lived experience, who have returned to the community and have been doing phenomenal work. There's agencies in our communities who want to take on this, the issues of reentry and working with the individuals who are returning back to their communities. And I think that they should be given an opportunity to do the work. Sad to say that in most 85 to 90% of the situations where individuals are working with individuals returning to the community, they are not people who look like those who are coming back into that community. And I feel that that is something that needs to change. Where do we start? I believe our legislators need to get together around criminal justice reform and have serious conversations. There's models out there. We have to look outside of our borders at what other states are doing, and how did they achieve some of the success that they have. Texas was one I just threw up there, but as far as community corrections, I remember not long ago, Michigan was doing community corrections in the same manner we were. That changed, their population is going down, and they're saving dollars. And we can invest on the front end. Treatment alternative diversions. I've sat on the Treatment Alternative Diversion Selection Committee, the Treatment Alternative Diversion Advisory Committee, and that's been over 10 years. And at that time, we invested $1 million. And in 10 years, today we spend $6 million. That is a mere fraction of what it's going to take to give judges more opportunities, more choices, and opportunities of funneling people not into the the prison system, but keeping them in their communities and getting them what they need.
That's Jerome Dillard speaking at our recent Across the Red and Blue Divide event, Reforming Criminal Justice. We'll have the second half of our conversation in just a moment on Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Let's get back to our recent panel discussion recorded at the Bavarian Beer House in Glendale called Across the Red and Blue Divide, Reforming Criminal Justice. Our guests are Milwaukee County Circuit Court Judge Jane Carroll, Democratic Representative David Bowen, Republican State Representative Rob Hutton, and Jerome Dillard, State Director for EXPO, Ex-Incarcerated People Organizing.
Mitch began by asking what the media gets wrong in covering criminal justice reform. Here's Rob Hutton.
It's a great question, and we all talk about the media and the role the media plays, positively and negatively, depending on the issue. I think when I sit with my kids at night and we watch the evening news, as an example, it creates an impression in all of our minds of what's happening either east of here, north of here, or south of here that may not be reality. And so I think there is a perception concern that things are probably to an extreme where they are, whether that's in the central city or even out in the suburbs. But yet I spend time in those communities and I hear from individuals talking about all the positive things that are happening in those communities, not only just around this issue, but around employment, around hunger, around education. And I think it's important that we have a balanced approach so as a society, we understand where there are real concerns that need to be addressed, but also where there are really wonderful things happening that we need to support and be a part of and endorse. So the opportunities we have to address some of those ills, I would argue, and Representative Bowen and I may disagree on this, but I think we come at it from the same vantage point. I think there are some really important things that can be done legislatively that should be done legislatively in Madison. I will transparently tell you, though, where I see most of the hope is happening in the communities from organizations that are kind of the unsung heroes that are fighting tooth and nail every day to drive important reforms that can fundamentally transform communities but also transform lives. And those are individuals and organizations that I would love to see receive more airtime, if you will, and have an opportunity to tell their story for what they're doing that, quite frankly, is working, that we need to not only support but also help grow, help sustain, and build upon as a very much of a bipartisan support in the communities or in Madison or wherever that case may be.
Jerome Dillard, when someone interviews you, what do you hear them get wrong about the story?
Well, I feel that oftentimes we focus on the effect, and we need to look at the cause and the effect. The judge brought up a very important point about traumas, and some of the communities, they're just under stress, what I call chronic stress, when you don't know how you're going to pay your bills and what if you're going to feed your kids or keep a phone on. Or those stressful situations are contagious. And I feel that living wage, something I was blessed with in returning to the community, was opportunities. Not that I'm special, but I did get some really special opportunities, and I'd like to see more of that. Individuals making a living wage, that's what took me out of my criminal activity that went on for 20 years. I was able to make a living wage with benefits and 401k, and it gave me an opportunity to let my wife, my now wife, we were dating at the time, go back to school and get her, finish her degrees. And I'm making a living wage and she's making a living wage, and life just got better for us. And I believe that opening opportunities for this population is key. It is key. We can train people, but if we're training them for a low-wage workforce, then we really, really got it twisted, because not much is going to change. These individuals need opportunities.
Judge Carroll, what do you think the media gets wrong?
It's not so much a matter of right or wrong, it's a matter of kind of perspective. And I think one of the ongoing conversations that we have to have, not only as journalists, but as criminal justice partners and legislators, is check your bias. It's out there, it exists, we all live under this big umbrella, this big cloud of bias that we have to look at head on, we have to talk about, and we have to address. That's one of the important things. And another thing, and I think these people are tremendous for saying, let's look and see what other people are doing, what's working. And there are some really amazing and exciting things happening in juvenile justice and criminal justice. And we know what works. And trying to find the political will to make that happen is hard. And I really congratulate the legislatures that we have here tonight. But in terms of the media, one of the things, I'll just give you a quick example, that Illinois is doing. The woman who just took over the Department of Juvenile Corrections in Illinois is really trying to de-incarcerate youth, and she's taking some of her most high-risk youth and sending them to college. They're out during the day on college campuses wearing regular clothes, looking and acting like any other 17, 18, 19-year-old youth. My concern about that program is no program is ever going to have 99% success. They could graduate 1,000 or 999 successful candidates, but that one candidate who commits another crime, that's going to be the headline. And that's what makes the political realities difficult for everybody. It's that is the person that the light gets shined on, and there's never another paragraph that says, hey, wait a minute, there were 999. So I guess I'd like to see some of the good that's happening in interventions have a little more light shined on it.
So maybe the better question here for you, Representative Bowen, is what should we be focusing on in the media?
And I think that's a great question. I feel that one of the things that I agree with Representative Hutton, there are folks that are in the community on the grassroots level that are working as hard as they possibly can to turn these issues around. I would say deeper reporting to allow those folks to also have access to the media to share their perspective. I think a lot of times when situations happen, you see an image of a young person jacking a car, you see an image of the destruction, but you don't get to hear the direct perspective of those that are on the ground that are attempting to turn that situation around. And seeking out those individuals throughout the community and making sure that their voices are a part of that story, I think would do wonders to make sure that we're not just seeing or hearing images and sounds of destruction, but also building as well.
You've been listening to Across the Red and Blue Divide, Reforming Criminal Justice, presented by WUWM and the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel in conjunction with the Zeidler Center for Public Discussion and the Millennial Action Project.
The event was recorded last week at the Bavarian Beer House and featured Republican State Representative Rob Hutton, Democrat State Representative David Bowen, Circuit Court Judge Jane Carroll, and Jerome Dillard of EXPO, Ex-Incarcerated People Organizing.
Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke and the Journal Sentinel's Aaron Richards moderated the discussion. And you can hear what came out of one of the event's discussion circles in Taryn Powell's story at WUWM.com.
Another break now, and then we'll reconnect with political satirist and Milwaukee native Will Durst ahead of his latest show back on Home Turf. That's when Lake Effect continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. While there are aspects of the news coming out of Washington that sound like satire, it's kind of hard to be sure. At least with our next segment, you can be very sure it's satire that you're hearing.
Will Durst is an award-winning political satirist who lives in California's Bay Area, but he is a Milwaukee native and he's back in his home state for shows this Friday in Madison and Saturday in Milwaukee. Before that, though, he stopped by our studios to talk with the two of us, Bonnie. Will Durst, it's good to see you.
Hey, how you doing, Mr. Mitch?
I am doing great. And how about you back in your hometown?
Oh, it's wonderful. It's summer in San Francisco, which means we've had three sunny days since July 1st.
And we were talking about this before I turned on the microphones. I just ran into a bunch of Giants fans when the Giants were in Milwaukee to play the Brewers. And we talked a little bit about baseball, and then it was the day that I ran into them. It was cloudy. It was 62 degrees. And I said, we rolled out the San Francisco weather just for you.
I was gonna say, they felt right at home.
And they said, it's actually warmer than it's been in San Francisco.
Well, the city itself gets the marine layer when the Central Valley heats up. And so 10 miles, maybe 6 miles from the coast, it's foggy. And then you go 20 miles beyond that, it's 90 degrees, you know. But San Francisco, I think our high was 62, 64 for most of July and August. But September and October, we get our good weather. So I can't
And
wait
so you're here.
Back. Yeah, right.
So that's how that works.
And then I go to Europe. And so, yeah, September and October kind of screwed for me.
For a political comedian, you're going to Europe.
I don't know.
I don't know. I'm just wondering.
I know what you're going to ask, and I don't know. I've heard that people are so tired of hearing about Trump. I've heard that people can't get enough of Trump. I have an hour and a half show, which I'll be doing this Saturday at the Comedy Sports Theater, which is 421 South First Street, and 7:30, $20.
You sound like a NASCAR driver working in all of your sponsors.
Yeah, my sponsors. Yeah. And tickets are available, brown paper tickets. And I have no idea how much of that hour and a half is going to translate to the European audience. So it's going to be—
Do you have a lot of Merkel material?
No.
You might want to work some of that in.
Yeah, well, I have a friend who's going to be opening up for me. He does a great bit. His name is Andy Velver, and he does a great bit about how Europe is like a family, and Britain is the mom, and Germany is the dad, and how Italy and Spain are the ne'er-do-well sons.
And they don't even talk to Greece.
Right.
Welcome at the table.
Exactly.
Strange.
Well, you could have written this bit, Ms. Bond. You know? Yeah. So they want me to do the reflection of what's going on here.
Which should be interesting.
Every day.
Are you keeping up with the tweets?
No. Yeah. No. Just when he tweets something in capitals. Oh, it must be true. It's all in capitals. Yeah. It's just reprehensible. And the fact that all the Republicans, I'm sorry, that they've just fallen in line. They hated him. He was disgusting. He was an oaf. He was a fool, a toad, a pinhead. And now because he got their donors a tax cut, oh, we love him. We'll do anything. Oh, paid off a porn star? No problem. The evangelicals gave him a mulligan on a porn star payoff while his third wife was pregnant.
You're sure this isn't Italy?
Yeah, I know. I could do the Berlusconi jokes.
At the same time, it has to be a little weird. Maybe weird's the wrong word, but there's got to be a difference doing Trump material in front of an audience in Germany or the Netherlands or whatever when you're an American comedian versus doing that same material in the United States when you're an American comedian.
Well, yeah, it has to do with shared references. Comedy always does. And you can either explode those shared references and, you know, go somewhere else, or you can exploit them. And the way my material is set up is every punchline is a setup for the next joke. So I don't have to spend a lot of time on exposition, which is really going to mess with my chi when I go over there. Yeah. But the hard part here is just keeping up. I mean, you know, the prosecutions and Rick Gates testified that he stole from Paul Manafort, who stole from Trump, who stole from everybody. They're like the Russian nesting dolls of crime. You know, I mean, it's hard to keep up.
Well, and you have to develop your material because I imagine there are plenty of people out there that developed a lot of great Scaramucci material.
Exactly.
And then you had nothing to do with it after a week.
And it's not just old. I mean, it's antique. It's medieval. Yeah, it's wearing a breastplate. My Omarosa material is starting to, but fortunately she released a tape today. So.
Oh, so that'll come back. You'll be able to use that.
She says she has 200 tapes. I mean, she learned. This is the classic case of the student surpassing the master. She out-trumped Trump. He must be so proud.
One of the things that when we first met each other and you first started coming on this show is what, like a dozen years ago now, at one point you considered yourself bipartisan.
I did.
You no longer do.
No. No, I have decided America spoke on November 8th and 2016, and I listened, so I'm going to go after him the same way he went after America. I have Democratic jokes, plenty of them. The reason the Democrats are so intent on passing the stem cell bill is they're depending on that research to generate a spine. I have plenty of Democratic jokes. But no, I'm going to use lies and alternative facts and blatant falsehood. I'm going to go after him.
We've noted this on many occasions. You are a Milwaukee area native. You now live in the Bay Area. You are back in the place that the Democrats are hoping to come ahead of the next presidential election.
Yeah. Is it possible they could have their convention here? Has there been talk?
It is very possible. There's a brand new basketball arena just down the street that I think a lot of people are thinking would be a perfect place for a political convention of some kind.
Do you have the hotels?
There were enough hotels to hold Giants fans earlier this week.
Yeah. There were a lot of them.
I know that tour. Yeah. I know the people who run that tour. We actually go – once a year they go to Hawaii, and we go on that. And I tell some jokes so we get a better room.
There are a lot of hotel rooms already. There are hotels under construction. There are hotels planned. So I think Milwaukee is portraying itself as a city that is ready for the big time in that way.
Well, I went to the one in Cleveland, and, you know, I was way out in, I don't know where I was, New Jersey or something. I was far out for that one. No, that was Philadelphia. I was in New Jersey for Philadelphia, yeah. For Ohio, where was I?
Canada, I think.
Yeah,
across the lake,
New York. Yeah, yeah, by Lake Erie. Yeah, yeah. The mistake on the lake.
So, if the Democrats do come here and they do have their convention here, I mean, what do you think? You grew up here. What do you think the response is going to be locally, not nationally?
Well, they always promise the city this incredible bounty of money coming in on hotel rooms and taxis and restaurants. And then what happens is the locals stay away, so nobody comes downtown. And then all the Democrats and all the lobby groups, they have their own events. And they're held in the hotels and stuff.
So you get sort of an alternative Milwaukee
right,
that goes on.
Yeah. Right. And the restaurants die. Unless they're within walking distance of the hotels that most people are staying in. So the rest – and the cabs die because everybody's calling, you know, the private buses to get their people. So, yeah, it's kind of a scam. You know, the city makes money, but the individual businesses are – yeah, it's not so good.
We're having this conversation on a Tuesday. There are primary elections going on in places around the country, as they have been leading up to this fall's midterms. What's your take on the potential for a blue wave this fall versus everything else you're hearing?
People got to vote. That's all it's about. It's a vote like they're going to take it away from you because they want to. It could happen, but if anybody could blow the midterms, it's the Democrats. They hold the world's record for rolling over on the self-destruct button in their sleep. It can snatch defeat from the jaws of victory, no matter how small the dental gap. Yeah, and I'm going to be flying that night, so I will have no idea. I'm going to wake up the next day, yeah.
Flying from?
San Francisco to New York. I'll be in the air during most of the election, which because that's one of my favorite things is watching, you know, Brian Williams, his little head pop off. And
does Brian Williams still exist?
Oh, yeah. He's on MSNBC
right,
now. Yeah. And it's difficult for him every day to come up with a new, hold on to your hats. You're not going to believe what happened today.
Well, and, you know, I was just thinking this the other day as I was listening to a promo for a story that was, I think it was News Analysis that was coming up on All Things Considered. And it started by saying something like, even in an historic year for politics in Washington, the events of this past week have been crazy. And I thought they could air this promo any week of the year.
Yeah, that graphic breaking news broke. You know, it's permanently illuminated now. There is no.
It doesn't ever turn off.
No. The new ones don't have off switches. Yeah. It is. I mean, you've seen it. Production assistants running out of the set during the cold open. Poor Rachel Maddow can't plan a show because people are coming up with new stuff. Anderson Cooper's going nuts, and I imagine Sean Hannity. Of course, Sean Hannity and Donald Trump, supposedly, they talk before bed every night. You hang up. No, you hang up. No, you hang up.
Looking ahead past the midterm elections, what do you think is going to happen? I mean, it's a serious question. A lot of this, as we've been saying, so much changes every minute. It happens so fast you don't have time to react to most of it. It just kind of washes by. You go, oh, okay, that was interesting. What? Oh, this is something. Does this end? And how?
Well, I'm the worst prognosticator in the world. I thought Hillary would win. I thought I am no good at this. But if the Democrats are able to pull this off and, you know, then they get the committee chairs of the House and they're able to instigate investigations and you know, things could happen. But I predict that either America or he will get attacked and we'll have to clamp down and there'll be loyalty oaths and you know, the martial law and he'll have his Minutemen out there who are an ersatz kind of military force. That's what I predict. So
so you're not hopeful is what you're saying.
No, yeah. I'm not.
Yeah.
And people who come to my show should know that they're actually contributing because every show, certain proceeds will go to a nonprofit whose mission will be to bury wire cutters along the Canadian border. Yeah, I am not hopeful at all. I don't believe this guy is going to give up, and I don't think there's anybody to stop him, you know? And then there's the other part, you know, then there's if they are successful in getting Trump out, either because of physical ailments or health problems or in impeachment proceedings or threatening to put his family in jail, then you got Mike Pence staring at you, which is, you know, that's scary. This guy, I'm not sure he's actually human. He might be one of those Disney animatrons. You know?
So people coming to the show this week or wherever, should they expect a catharsis in any way?
Yes. That's what the show is. It's half therapy, it's half comedy. I'm a theramedian is what I am, and I'm helping people overcome
their
PTSD.
Do you have the instrument?
That's a theremin.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, sorry.
Oh,
yeah. You did mention robots, and yeah. I was thinking, went to science fiction, and I, yeah,
oh,
sorry.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, very
thank
good.
You. My,
yeah, Forbidden Planet.
Thank you. Yes, yeah. One of my many talents is the in-studio theremin imitation.
We use it a lot, as you
mentioned. Yeah. Especially down here.
So I mentioned the Giants fans that were in town the other day, and you are a Wisconsinite living in the Bay Area. Better year this year to root for the Brewers than the Giants. How about the Packers and 49ers dynamic for you?
Yeah, that's October 15th, I think it is, they're playing. And that's a tough one because I grew up Packer fan. We had tickets at County Stadium. Vince Lombardi said, oh, don't get in an AFL team because we'll stay in Milwaukee forever. And then he screwed us, just like the guys from Chicago who bought the Braves in 1965 and said we'll stay in Milwaukee forever. And then they screwed us next year, moved them to Atlanta. So that's why I hate Atlanta and I hate Chicago. Really, I hate Chicago.
Well, so you could not have been happier with how the Packers-Bears game turned
oh,
out.
Oh, my God. Yeah, no, I love Chicago, the town. I think it's wasted on Chicagoans. Really. You know that whole thing where they say in New York they're smart but ugly, and in L.A. they're pretty but stupid? Well, Chicago, they're ugly and stupid. Yeah. So that's I never did well in Chicago. And
I can't imagine why not.
Yeah,
with that attitude.
I open with that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Alienate him right off the bat.
And Atlanta, I'm convinced that Sherman didn't finish the job.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So those are two.
So
no,
Marta versus Metro, it's really a Hobson's choice.
You don't do that to a 12-year-old kid. You don't steal his baseball team. I mean, I grew up a big Braves fan. So, but Packers still stayed with me. But I was just in Sturgeon Bay, and we had great crowds, full crowds, four nights at the Third Avenue Playhouse. And so I'm going to go back once a year, and maybe next year be able to do Washington Island. And I love coming back to Wisconsin. I love coming back to Wisconsin.
Well, I
thank you guys
for having
me.
So much.
Promoting my little gig Saturday night, Comedy Sports Theater, 421 South First Street, 7:30, 85 minutes, no intermission, just me mocking and scoffing and taunting, but with taste.
Well, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Great to see you. Political satirist and Milwaukee native Will Durst performs Friday night at the Barrymore Theater in Madison and Saturday night at Comedy Sports Theater in Milwaukee. You can find a link to all things Durst at WUWM.com.
We talk plenty of baseball with Will Durst. One more break, and then we'll talk some more about baseball, but baseball history as seen through the experience of one immigrant group. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. It's Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. When you talk about Italian-American baseball players, the name Joe DiMaggio immediately springs to mind. But Milwaukee writer Lawrence Baldessaro made the point in a past book that there are more names in Italian-American baseball experience than that one luminary. And the book is called Beyond DiMaggio.
Baldessaro's most recent book goes further than that and presents the stories of several generations of Italian-American ballplayers in their own words, spoken in interviews Baldessaro has conducted over the years. That collection is called Baseball Italian Style, and Larry Baldessaro joined us in the studio this spring. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So when did this all start? When did you first start seeking out ballplayers and speaking with them about their Italian heritage and the experience of being an Italian-American ballplayer?
The first interview I did with an Italian-American ballplayer, because I had written some about baseball before that, but in June 1993, the Yankees were in town, and one of their radio broadcasters was Phil Rizzuto. So I scheduled an interview with him, and the only reason I was doing that, it was going to be published in a baseball journal called Elysian Fields Quarterly. I had no idea then I was going to follow up on this, but thing was, the Scooter, as he was known, was such a great interview. I mean, you turned on your recorder, ask him a question, and sit back. He was fabulous. So I guess that kind of motivated me then to seek out others as they came through Milwaukee. And then at a certain point, the light finally dawned on me because I had written about Ted Williams, who was my boyhood hero. But here I am, the grandson of four Italian immigrants. I teach Italian. I love baseball. Why don't I write about Italians in baseball? And it turns out that virtually nothing had been written. So that's when I set out to write a book that became known as Beyond DiMaggio, which was the first extensive history of Italian Americans in baseball. And in the process of doing that, I conducted about 50 or more interviews with players, coaches, managers, et cetera, owners, and this is where it's come to.
Well, and I'm curious, the journalist in me read this and was, you know, really struck by how expansively some of these people talk about this part of their lives and their heritage, and, you know, comparing it to the experience I've had interviewing ballplayers who sometimes it's difficult to get, you know, a sentence of more than four or five words out of them, especially about something that's not linked directly to the game they just played, the game they're about to play, the games that they played in their past. How willing were these folks to talk about this part of who they are?
What's interesting, and this is not surprising, that the earlier ball players, and you know, I spoke to six players whose careers began in the 1930s, they were still very much connected to their heritage because they were the children of immigrants. The further removed you get from the immigrant generation, the less identity there is, especially after World War II when there was more intermarriage. People moved around more, so there's less connection to the family. So those early ball players were, you know, willing and eager to talk about their background. Everybody that I spoke to did, but as I say, the more contemporary players have less of a sense. More and more of them, I'd say maybe since the 70s on, tend to identify, and they're all, every one of them expressed pride in their Italian heritage, but they knew less about it. They didn't speak the language for the most part. They essentially identified themselves as Americans.
Right. The first people you speak with, I'm struck by the longevity that some of these guys had. You know, you spoke with Frank Grassetti, who, yeah, he was playing in the 30s.
1932, yeah, he started.
And at the time they broke in, it seems like there was something really distinctive about their place as Italian-American ball players that probably does not hold true in the same way today.
No, but it did. You know, the history of baseball is like the history of America. You can't talk about it without talking about immigration and ethnic succession. So as each ethnic group, especially from Europe, came in, the Germans, the Irish, you know, they faced some reluctance, some skepticism, some obstacles about playing professional baseball. At the same time, baseball did offer to these children of immigrants, whether German, Irish, later Italians, Slavs, Jews, etc., that baseball provided one avenue to them to fulfill the American dream, because a lot of other avenues were not really open to them. So those early players, when they did break in, like Crosetti and others, they faced some prejudice, mainly in the form of ethnic slurs, which were part of the common vernacular at the time up until World War II and a little beyond. So much so that terms like Dago and WAP, which you would never see in print today, would appear in the New York Times. It was just part of the vernacular. So when these players broke in, some fans would, you know, holler these terms at them in a derogatory way. Several of the people that played in the 30s said that they would hear these fans yelling out. And they would hear it from players, opposing teams. However, if it was used within the ball club by other Italians, then it was, not only was it not offensive, it was termed, there was a term of endearment.
You talk about players who came of age before World War II, and so many of these players were, you know, the children of immigrants, very recent immigrants. What was their family's attitude towards their wanting to pursue a career in baseball?
Look, the Italians who came here knew nothing. They brought no tradition of sports other than bocce. So the idea that their children could make a living playing a game that they considered a child's game and a waste of time was beyond them. So for the most part, parents were objecting. Sometimes you get the father who'd object and the mother who would support, or vice versa. So that was a sort of an internal obstacle to some of these people who broke into the game. You know, Papa Giuseppe DiMaggio thought that he had five sons and he wanted them all to go to be fishermen like him in San Francisco. And the two oldest brothers did, but then Vince, Joe, and Dom didn't want to be fishermen. They wanted to be ball players. Well, actually, Vince wanted to be an opera singer, but he ended up spending 10 years in the major leagues. Well, Dominic DiMaggio, when I spoke to him here in Milwaukee, said that, you know, his father would take Vince, the oldest son, take his spikes and his gloves and throw them in the garbage can, and then Mom would go pull them out before the next game. And then when Vince became a professional and made money, and this is in the Depression, and then Joe became a professional, now Dom, the youngest, he said, my father came to me and said, when are you going to start playing baseball?
And I can't remember which player it was who his father spoke only broken English or little English at all, and he, you know, signed his first professional contract. And the father asks him how much it's for, and he says $36,000. And the father says, oh, my God, what a great country this is.
Right. That was Joey Amalfitano, 1954, signed as a bonus baby with the Giants. Yeah.
You mentioned DiMaggio and the DiMaggios. It's funny, your last book was called Beyond DiMaggio, but at the same time, the specter of DiMaggio looms really large in the lives of so many of these players, right up through Mike Piazza.
Absolutely. You know, I refer to DiMaggio as the patron saint of Italian-American fans and ballplayers. So many of the people in the book refer to him. Whether it was people who played with or against him in his era, or people who came later and talked about, you know, how their parents idolized this man, because here he was, an Italian, after the prejudice they had faced, and he was, you know, this huge star in the national pastime that gave them some hope that they could succeed. It gave them a sense of pride. And this was repeated over and over again by older players and younger ones as well. Yeah, his figure looms very large.
There are a number of players who describe the scene at going into games at Yankee Stadium and whole sections of people watching DiMaggio in the outfield more than they watch what's going on at home plate.
Right. Rico Petrocelli, who went on to become a Red Sox star and sat in the center field bleachers with his older brothers, and he said, I realized I was looking at the DiMaggio, and I looked around, and everybody was looking at DiMaggio. They weren't looking at the pitcher or the batter. He said that's how much of a hero he was.
With only a few exceptions, New York and San Francisco seemed like the places where many of these players grew up. And to that end, there were a couple of really influential ball fields that figure into the lives of some of these players that I wanted to ask you about. What can you tell us about Funston Playground, and that's in San Francisco, and the Parade Grounds in Brooklyn?
San Francisco was a hotbed of amateur baseball, even in the late 19th century. And, of course, the weather was good out there. And technically, I think there was less prejudice against minority groups in San Francisco, other than the Chinese, I would say, but certainly less than Italians and others encountered on the East Coast. So a lot of these kids just naturally gravitated to baseball. A lot of them who lived in what is now called Joe DiMaggio Field, which is in the North Beach playground, where they played on concrete. That's where the DiMaggios got their start and others. And then Funston Field was just a couple of miles away, and that had several ball fields. So that's where you would go early in the morning, and there'd be games going on all day long. And that's where they developed. There were scouts there, and they signed them, particularly in the Pacific Coast League and the minor leagues. In New York, the Parade Grounds in Brooklyn was the place to play. And there's so many major leaguers who came out of there. The Torrey brothers, just to mention two. Sandy Koufax came out of there, others as well. So those were just training grounds where you got a lot of attention. People knew the good ball players were there, and the scouts would come.
Well, Larry Baldessaro, fascinating stuff. Thank you so much for sharing at least some of it with us.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Larry Baldessaro's latest book is called Baseball Italian Style, Great Stories Told by Italian-American Major Leaguers from Crosetti to Piazza. Baldessaro is a professor emeritus of Italian at UW-Milwaukee, and our interview with him first aired this spring. And that's the last out for today's show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Thanks so much for sticking with us today, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Fresh air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.